You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
And it's John Gibbons for the Anfield Wrap, and I'm joined over Zoom by Jonathan Liu. Just in reaction to something Jonathan wrote yesterday, I'm sure as sports fans you'll have seen the news coming out of the French Open around Naomi Osaka and her deciding that she had to pull out to the French Open. As usual, the best thing on this was written by Jonathan. So we have Jonathan here on Zoom to talk about it a little bit further, but also to explore some of the things that Jonathan talked about in a little bit more detail. So Jonathan, thanks so much for coming on the Zoom this morning.
Thank you for having me.
It's an interesting area. It's an interesting take that you sort of put on it. I think in this instance, the Anfield Wrap has to classify itself as the media. We try and go through both lines pretty much when it suits us, but I think it is fair for us to classify ourselves as media on this one. And I guess, you know, the question is, to quote David Mitchell, are we the baddies?
Well, I mean, obviously, it is a lot more it's a lot more nuanced than that, because, you know, there are obviously great people in the media doing great work. And there are a load of people who, you know, for want of a better word, are kind of parasites, doing very little useful and very little useful work, and actually doing quite a lot of harm, not just to the people they're writing about, but to the profession, you know, capital T, capital P. So, you know, it's a mixed picture. But I think what a lot of journalists, and especially those who have kind of been in the business for a while, are often quite blind to is like people really, really hate us. You know, you just take the temperature out there. You know, whether it's the right or whether it's the left or whether it's the political class or football fans or whatever. Like people don't trust journalists anymore. People don't trust the media. It's kind of somewhere in between politicians and estate agents. And like there comes a point where you have to stop pointing, like blaming people for that, and actually take a little bit of a look inside. Your own house, and journalism has traditionally, I think, been really quite bad at that, because for so long newspapers certainly, but also television and radio, held so much power, and you know there have been so many trappings and so much entitlement that go with that, that, you know, a few decades down the line you look out the window and like we don't have this power anymore. People don't really care what we have to say, and I think people take that quite badly, and you know that's why kind of a conversation needs to be had, because the media is so important, a good free media, and yet it's never been less trusted, and I think that has to be addressed.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? I want to pick up on a few things you said there, but on the idea of the perception versus the reality, if you like, do you think sort of journalism has almost seems to have the biggest gap between how people in it see themselves and how the rest of the world? I mean, you mentioned there that politicians, but at least politicians seem to have a grasp that, you know, that they are quite unpopular, whereas within an estate agent itself, you know, with journalism, there seems to be the biggest jump between, yeah, how people within the industry sort of see themselves and how sort of, you know, other people outside.
Yeah, I mean, politicians at least have to submit themselves to elections every 4 or 5 years, and literally, you know, people can tell them you suck. Whereas, although the, you know, social media has kind of changed the dynamic between journalists and the public quite significantly over the last few years, for most of the history of this profession, you turned up and you did your job, and you kind of pontificated and you know, decided what people were going to read, and that was the end of it. You know, you somehow, by dint of your position, got to decree what people read and cared about. And I think, you know, that has changed so significantly, and people still don't really kind of realize that. So yeah, there is a perception gap. And the other thing is, you know, when you're in the media and you do have this kind of platform, there's very high self-regard in this profession, because so many people, you know, read what we say, and you know, we all have blue ticks on Twitter and whatever. So, you know, somebody once said Twitter was where celebrities think they're journalists and journalists think they're celebrities. I can't take any credit for that there, but it's so true. Like, really kind of, you know, two-bit journalists think they're the dog's bollocks. Sorry. You know, because they have a blue tick and 10,000 followers. Anyway, so yeah, there is this kind of, you know, you get a special seat in the ground or in the stadium, and you know, you get a voucher for free food, and you know, you get a special entrance. You know, it's easy to think that you're kind of special in this job, but you're not. You're just a person with a laptop and some words.
I think part of the problem is, and I guess why your piece sort of stood out so much, is that so often the media is sort of judge, jury and executioner on whether the media have done anything wrong. And I've heard it so many times. I remember I was driving home from somewhere and had Five Live on, and a boxer came, it was a heavyweight boxer came on, and he was talking about that he felt he'd been unfairly treated by the media, and he said this, and then it went back to the studio, and then everyone in the media decided he was wrong. And I felt like, and I thought, someone at some point's got to come on and say, well, yeah, but maybe we're not the best judge of this. Do you know what I mean? Maybe we've got sort of skin in the game. And it happens all the time. And it happens, sorry to bring it back to Liverpool, but, you know, that's what Liverpool fans do. This season with Jurgen Klopp, and when he did an interview with BT, and he was talking about the fact that you people keep putting these games on at 12:30 and it's not fair. And then it goes back to the BT studio, and everyone who's paid by BT says, oh, this is ridiculous. You know, how can you moan about this? Blah, blah, blah. And no one at any point goes, well, should we explore maybe that he's got a point, or should we at least explore that maybe we've got a little bit of bias in this? It's kind of like this idea of, you know, the media kind of gets to decide, you know, whether criticism of the media is fair or not.
Yeah, I mean, the instinct is very much to close ranks. And I, you know, what I would point out is that I kind of, a lot of that solidarity is actually quite admirable. You know, the way that journalists from rival papers will kind of stick up for each other, will help each other out. That side of it is often comes from a really, really quite a benevolent place. But taken across the industry as a whole, there really does seem to be this kind of this strange and unchallenged orthodoxy that you don't criticize your own profession. You don't challenge a fellow journalist, that on some level we're all kind of fighting the same fight here. And I just think that's so wrong. You know, if the Mail on Sunday publishes something like absolutely egregious about Marcus Rashford, it's contingent upon us who kind of believe in good journalism to call that stuff out, because it doesn't just, you know, that doesn't just reflect on the Mail on Sunday. It reflects on all of us, because people don't have, you know, people don't have, you know, an entirely nuanced view of the media. So, you know, if one publication publishes something that you know is terrible, that reflects, you know, that reflects on the whole profession. And I think there's not enough of a recognition of that, and that's why, you know, when there are ridiculous things like, you know, I've read about press conferences, you know, which I just think it's just such a, you know, an inefficient way of communicating information. It's such an artificial setup. You know, when you identify something like that in your own industry, you know, it's contingent on us to say something about that, because, you know, that's, you know, the self-criticism is often the most effective form.
Absolutely. to talk a little bit about sort of Naomi's situation then, because you know it's long been thought that maybe the best time to get someone isn't straight after a sporting performance. You know, the best time to speak to someone, you know, and then also the fairest time to speak to someone in football, which obviously is a sport I know more. People are shoved, you know, microphones shoved in the faces afterwards. In tennis, though, it seems so much more intense, and often it's younger people and younger players, and especially on the women's side, it seems like the girls, and that's what they are, break through at sort of younger ages. You've got 16, 17 year olds who are suddenly thrust into quite an intense environment, really, and with a lot of people who don't look like them. And I say that as someone who next year will be a white man in his 40s. and you know, it seems like, as I say, this is a sport-wide problem and a sport-wide issue and a sport-wide something to think and talk about. But in tennis, and especially for young female players, it seems to be, to me, a kind of a more kind of intense version.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you put yourself in the shoes of, you know, like a 19-year-old women's tennis player who, you know, has maybe just come off court after a defeat, and you walk into this room, and it's similar in at all the Grand Slams, but generally, you know, you walk and there's sort of plush theatre, you know, cinema style seats, maybe 50, 100 people there, maybe it's empty apart from a few people, which if anything is even more intimidating, and they're all kind of, you know, well, 80 or 90% are men in there, you know, between the age of 30 and 70, and they, you know, there's also a bank of lights, you know, really bright lights, because you're being filmed, and you're being probed on why you lost, what are your weaknesses. You know, they can literally ask you anything they want, and the situation and precedent dictates that they will kind of ask you anything they want. And I'm not surprised that so many athletes find that a really alienating scenario. And it doesn't serve journalism any purpose either, because you're not going to get good, true, insightful answers from that interaction. Especially because you're essentially putting this person on the defensive. As you'll know, like, you know, the Anfield Rap has done, you know, you sat down with Trent Alexander-Arnold and Jurgen Klopp, and you get far more in a kind of an informal, small group conversant scenario than you do by sticking them up in, you know, on a platform and shining lights at them and giving them, you know, just you know, bombarding them with questions on all different kinds of topics with no warning. So you know, I just think we can do that whole interaction a lot better. And it is a sport wide issue as well, because, you know, cornering somebody straight after they won or lost is, you know, essentially mining their emotions for content. It's the commodification of emotion for media content. It's just really inefficient. And I think we can do better.
It's interesting, isn't it, around the sort of changing attitudes of sporting people as well. And you had Billie Jean King, who I think spoke quite fairly and also spoke, you know, honestly to her. And that's all you can sort of ask for anyone, really, you know. But she talked about, you know, when she was playing, the recognition of the need of a two-way kind of communication system, or a two-way something for something else. So you know, a sport that needs promotion, you know, this is the vehicle behind it. And so, you know, we'll put up with certain things to get us at certain other things. But she also recognised that wasn't the case anymore. And you sort of touched on that earlier, really, is that there's likely to be more and more young athletes, or you're just young people in any walk of life, really, with a platform. We were thinking, well, hang on, I've got 4 million followers on my Twitter. I'm meant to worry about a newspaper of circulation 100,000. You know, I don't feel like I have to do that. And, you know, putting aside for a second the mental health things and the idea of, you know, the anxiety of putting yourself through it, I think there'll surely be more and more people going, well, why do I have to?
Yeah, I mean, it made sense, I think, 30 or 40 years ago when, you know, you had a few newspapers and, you know, the world itself was a lot smaller and more intimate. But if you look at a press conference in any sport these days, you know, you go to a Premier League press conference or the Olympics or a big Grand Slam tennis tournament, and you have no idea who half the people in there are, and you don't know what they're doing. This is, I mean, I was talking about you know, kind of parasites earlier. You'll get people who have no business being in a press conference, who just want, you know, who just want to be there, soak up the atmosphere. They'll have finagled a media accreditation for some reason, and they just want to sit there basking in the limelight, or they want a selfie with Usain Bolt. And their purpose is not journalism, it's ego, or it's, you know, just you know, being there. And I think the loosening of that whole scenario, which is, you know, I think enabled by a lot of media officers who just think, well, it's easier, just let's just throw everybody in a room, and then, like, that's our media, you know, obligations done. It's just, it doesn't work for anyone. And yeah, it certainly doesn't work for people with large platforms, you know, whether that's in sport or music or whatever. If you can talk to, you know, Naomi Osaka, I think, you know, must have 10 million followers on social media. She didn't need to talk to, you know, The Times or, you know, USA Today. That doesn't serve her any good, particularly in a scenario where the only way that journalists gain something from that is if she loses something, if she says something untoward or ill-advised. It just doesn't make sense. So I think, you know, you are going to see that dynamic play out a lot more in all different kinds of sports. This is just the start of it.
Well, the tournament's scared of then, because, you know, surely the tournaments want the big stars. They want to keep the big stars happy. I know there's sponsors and there's sponsor obligations and things like that, but surely there's a better way of fulfilling sponsor needs than sticking someone who doesn't want to be there in front of a board with the sponsors' names on.
Yeah. I mean, if you're a big star and if you're a tennis player and you get to the final of a Grand Slam tournament, you'll have to do like a press conference before the start of the tournament, one after every game, plus, you know, TV after every game you play. So that's 7 matches, plus, you know, a load of kind of individual requests from radio, TV, whatever. And, you know, when you're trying to win a tournament, that's just not what you want to do. You know, like I touched on earlier, small group scenarios are so much more conducive to generating good, insightful interviews. And so if you emphasize that, if you emphasize one-on-one interviews, which I think then reward journalists who have, you know, who invest the time and the contact into, you know, into developing good relationships, then I think you just get much better content, for want of a better word. It doesn't serve anybody. It doesn't serve anybody's interest at the moment, and it can be made more efficient for everyone.
What do you think is likely to sort of, you know, happen off the back of this? Because, you know, a lot of people are saying, you know, the tournaments won't care or whatever, but it's never good to have your sort of number two player sort of pull out of something. You know, there are people who are critical of Naomi, but also, you know, people who are being critical of the French Open, and also, you know, tennis, you know, wider, because it was a joint statement made, it should be said. You know, I guess what I'm asking you, and it's a difficult question, is sort of what happens next from here?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a huge wake-up call. They will not. The French Open certainly would not have expected her to do this at all. And Osaka pulling out of the French Open, it hits their prestige, it hits their viewing figures, it hits their TV audiences, it hits their, their sponsorship potential. And in the long term, you know, one of the, you know, the highest earning female athletes in the world, and one of the most recognizable athletes in the world, against the written media, like the non-rights holding media, it's not going to be much of a contest. So, you know, if this is about power and influence, then ultimately I think, and especially if other players decide, hang on, I don't want any part of this process either, I think there's only going to be one winner in the long term.
So how does the media then adapt? I mean, I know you've talked about sort of searching out sort of things, but you know, if you think about the media across sports and in football in particular, you know, for the you know, journalists covering, say, Liverpool. You know, you've got Liverpool, who've got their own LFC channel. You've got the sports stars. You've got their own, you know, large Twitter followers. You've got fan media like us. It must feel like there's sort of, there's people everywhere, you know, out to sort of, you know, to sort of go it their own way. How does traditional media, move on from criticizing the journalist, and not criticizing the journalist, criticizing the athletes, if you like, and instead sort of, you know, plan a way forward for themselves?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to have to be a lot smarter and nimbler. I mean, one of the reasons that the press conference has grown into this, you know, grotesque beast over the last few decades is because quotes journalism is just really easy, cheap, space-filling journalism. You can fill a newspaper with what stuff a manager says, you know, a whole page on what Thomas Tuchel or Sean Dyche said yesterday. And you know, you just transcribe, basically. Turn your recorder on and write what happened. And so there's this whole tranche of the industry which is just geared to press conferences, going to press conferences and trying to spin the best line out of it, whether it's through kind of leading questions or tendentious questions, you know, and you get to know like the classic press conference questions after a while, the ones that are guaranteed to get a headline. It's like, how good can this player be? Like, what have you set a goal target? Will you have a word with this player, you know, after like they've had a red card or something? And then that gets spun the next morning into, you know, crisis talks, showdown meetings. You know, we all know how these things work. And people are getting wise to that now. There is still an audience out there for good journalism, thoughtful journalism, well-researched journalism, like exclusive news stories, sourced through good contacts. There's just this whole fat burg of a middle, which is nothing but what this person said yesterday. Is it interesting? Doesn't matter. We'll just print it. Fine. Send or, you know, publish. And that is the part that I think is going to have to be culled, because it's just a waste of everyone's time.
Have you found the reaction then, just to finish off, Jonathan, how do you find the reaction to your piece? How have you found the reaction to what you've seen generally online? Because it's been the usual sort of gnashing of teeth from certain people. Not least Piers Morgan, of course. He will never miss an opportunity to slag off a young woman. But you know, from generally speaking, you know, have you found the online discourse around what you've written or generally around the story? And has it surprised you kind of, or is everyone just acting out the way they normally do?
There has been an element of that, you know, people kind of playing their roles. But I think kind of encouragingly, it's not necessarily turned into, you know, a big culture war thing. And I think that's because there is a broad recognition that mental health is a real thing that anybody can suffer from, whether you're, you know, a millionaire athlete or whether you're not. And so, you know, I think vaguely encouraged by the direction and the substance and the intelligence of the discourse on this. You know, the same idiots will say the same idiotic things and there's nothing you can do about that. But I think the vast majority of what I've seen has been, you know, if somebody claims to have mental health issues, it is the humane and compassionate thing to believe them. And I think starting from that point has been really quite beneficial to the tone of the discourse. So you know, I'm vaguely encouraged because this stuff is being discussed in a way that it wouldn't have been 5 or even 2 years ago. And the fact that one of the world's most visible athletes has taken this stand, you know, and you know, to the detriment, I think, of our own mental health. But the fact that these issues are being discussed in a slightly more enlightened way than they might have otherwise been is a good thing.
Absolutely. Huge thanks to Jonathan for joining us. Do read the piece on The Guardian and then read everything else Jonathan has ever written. I mean, that'll take a while, but you know, it'll be good use of time. Thanks a lot, Jonathan. Really nice to speak to you this morning. Sports Social Podcast Network.